Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for your support of our locally owned bookstore. We very much appreciate you being here tonight. Brent Weeks' best-selling Night Angel trilogy has been called mesmerizing, compelling, impressive, and unforgettable. His new work, The Black Prism, the first in the Lightbringer trilogy, has already received rave reviews, mostly. But who reads those reviews in The Onion anyway? Grasping for the Wind, an online sci-fi and fantasy news and reviews site, called the new book truly visionary and original. And though I'm only a short way into it, I would definitely agree. We are delighted to welcome Brent to the Tattered Cover to present his new book to you tonight. Please join me in welcoming Brent Weeks.
Thank you very much. How am I doing on the sound? Okay, is that? I really debated what I was going to read for you guys tonight because, of course, there's people here who have never heard of me and are just curious, and there's people here who've read the Night Angel books, and people here who've read Black Prism already, and certainly people who've read the they posted the first three chapters online. So I decided that instead of reading something that you may have already written or you may have already read, and then if you bought the book, you'd have to read it again to make sure you got the gist, that I would read you something else that I wrote instead. And this essay addresses a few of the questions that I get a lot, like, do you use real people in your work? Where do you get your ideas from? And what kind of themes do you like to wrestle with? So this essay is called BBs, Grizzlies, and How I Wrote the Black Prism. I am a cheater. The first time I cheated in college, it wasn't for grades, it wasn't for money, and it wasn't even for love. "Brent, you gotta help me," Kevin said on the phone. My brother needed a monologue on a personal subject to deliver to his theater class. He was stuck, he'd tried, wah, 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 you know. Naturally, it was due the next morning. So he cajoled, he flattered, but most of all, my big brother needed me. So I huffed and puffed and made pointed jokes and told lies about how much homework I had. And after midnight, tired, irritable, and imagining Kevin sleeping snugly in his bed, I began wrestling with my keyboard. Within moments, a little Grinch grin spread over my face. "Write you a monologue, huh?" The tale my brother recited flawlessly the next day, he has this infuriatingly keen memory, was true-ish. When we were children, we would play in the vegetable garden after my dad rototilled it, churning up big hunks of clay that would bake brick hard in the eastern Montana sun. One day when we were 12, Kevin, and 8 years old, respectively, I played innocently as my brother, who was a little league pitcher, threw dirt clods into the air. He chucked one so high it pierced the mesosphere. On re-entry, trailing flames as it slowed to roughly 750 miles per hour, it landed flat on my head, knocking me out cold. In his monologue, my brother expressed how he was afraid that he'd killed me because he was afraid he'd get in trouble. He tried to figure out how to hide the body. He looked on the bright side. At least that irritating little tag-along was finally gone. I drew him as a monster, and his baby brother as the little golden retriever that just wanted to be with him. It was a thing of beauty. Consigning Kevin to at least 10 minutes of in-class purgatory, I felt positively Dantean in my passive-aggressive triumph. Kevin sold it, too. Never accused the man of flinching. But he didn't get an A. When he got his peer evaluations, which were supposed to judge only his delivery, he found out why. Against a majority of A's, three people had given him low grades, each complaining about the content. One gave him an F, explaining, "I'm a little brother. F you." Unfortunately, if I was a bit Dante, Kevin had always been a whole lot Sun Tzu. You know, the guy who wrote The Art of War. My fight record stands as evidence of Kevin's pursuit of this ancient Chinese wisdom. I went 0, 4,363, and 1. Kevin understood instinctively that if you seek out conflict when you have the upper hand, you can intimidate your opponent from seeking out conflict when he does. So, one day, after a friendly afternoon of shooting pop cans and perhaps neighbors' windows, my brother turned to me, BB gun cradled in his arms. "Brent," he said, his tone flat, a dangerous, dangerous tone I knew so well. "Brent, run." He chambered a 4.5 millimeter orb of copper-colored pain and pumped the gun once. "Kevin, no! Kevin, don't do it! I'll give you to the count of three." This was him being sporting. One. He looked at me quizzically. I had the opportunity to run, but if I wanted to make myself an easy target, well, there's just no understanding some people, is there? The corner of the house, safety, was at least 10 yards away, though. And of course, once I ran, that slow 1, 2, 3 would become 1, 2, 3. Two. "Kevin, no, please, I haven't done anything." The BB gun could handle 10 pumps, each adding more air pressure. At one, it would give you a wicked sting, but it wouldn't break skin. He pursed his lips. He shook his head. "You asked for it," he said. He added a second pump, another 137 feet per second, another 2.4 yowls on the welt scale. But to pump a Daisy air rifle requires taking the gun off target, and I was off like a Montana grizzly, a mobile mountain moving 33 miles per hour. In addition to being surprisingly fast, it turns out that from 5 yards, a grizzly is also surprisingly difficult to miss. Not that I was always so defenseless. The best offense can be a weak defense. Classic ambush. After a long day of low-level fighting, Kevin punched me right in front of Mom, and she threatened him with spankings or gruesome death. I can't remember after all these years. She turned her back, and while Kevin did nothing, I howled and held my arm. When she turned around, the pure hatred on his face was all the evidence she needed for a swift conviction. From behind her back, as she marched him out to the back deck for a date with a wooden spoon we called the ass cracker, I grinned my little Grinch grin at him and waved. But years later, everything was to change. The pastor of our church was inside the house, having a cup of coffee with this nice, stable family with well-behaved children. I was 17, big from football, big from weightlifting, and just big. More importantly, I was finally bigger than Kevin, who was 21 years old and coming back from college, where he was studying the oh-so-manly art of opera singing. Kevin looked for a fight, and he found one. Did I mention his martial arts? He hurt me, but I didn't stop. Today would be different. Stomach shots, shoulder thumpings, wrist locks, wrestling in the driveway. He hurt me so bad that, big football player that I was, I cried. Crying, I was humiliated. Humiliated, I was enraged. I took the worst of it and kept going. File under Berserker Grizzly. It scared the hell out of him. The fear in his eyes, to me, was a foretaste of sweet, sweet victory. And then he did the one thing he'd never done in 4,000 fights. The one thing that was utterly out of bounds. He punched me in the face. I was stunned for a moment, not just from the pain, though it hurt, but from sheer outrage. He'd taken the rule book and crapped all over it. Then I attacked. I tackled him, shrugged off some blows, ended up on top, and took his golden throat in both hands. His beautiful tenor was his most precious possession. I throttled him. Then, as I held my brother down, smacking his head on the asphalt, I had a thought. What am I gonna do? Kill him? I hesitated. He threw me off. We staggered apart, a cold realization hitting both of us. If we ever fought again, someone was going to get maimed or killed. Literally. So thus ended my fighting career, on its highest note, a draw. I staggered inside, shirtless, splotchy, teary, dirty, bloody, and stormed right past the pastor. Sorry, Mom and Dad. For my whole adolescence, I knew that there were benefits to fighting my brother. It taught me how tough I was and how tough I wasn't. It taught me the difference between simple pain and actual injury. It taught me that when something knocks the wind out of you, you will not, in fact, die. All useful to know in publishing. Best of all, I knew that Kevin would always have my back if we ever had to fight anybody else. He was my best friend, and that kid was tough. But it was years before I would see that last fight and all the others from my brother's perspective. Kevin and I were about the same size from the time that I was 4 years old and he was eight. For my brother, and perhaps for any older brother, every fight was an existential struggle. He had to win. There was no other choice. So he fought harder, he studied martial arts, and when it came down to it, he broke the rules. And recently, that's what's fascinated me most of all. The rules we obeyed when fighting, and what it takes for those rules to break down. I don't recall being told that it was okay to hit in the shoulder, but wrong to hit in the face. I don't know how I absorbed that it was fine to inflict pain, but trying to inflict permanent damage was unacceptable, dishonorable, disloyal. I know now that my brother needed me to run away from that BB gun because he wouldn't risk shooting me in the face. And man, I wish I knew that then. Sometimes after a compliment about my characterization skills, I'm asked if I model my characters on real people. Emphatically no, and just a little bit yes. I don't paste in my mom and have a character look like, talk like, and react like she would. Doing that seems fundamentally uninteresting to me. It also seems like a good way to infuriate my mom when I have her cheat on my dad, lie to the police, and burn down the house. That said, I do use real people. I use everything that fascinates me. If I see someone's endearing quirk, I'll lift it, change it, and use it shamelessly. I don't know how I could write at all if I refuse to use what I learn, what intrigues me, and what moves me. The Black Prism and the Lightbringer series is a story about two brothers who respect and fear and admire and contend with and shape each other. In other words, it's a story of normal brothers who happen to be in extraordinary circumstances. It's not Kevin's and my story, but without losing those 4,363 fights, I couldn't have written the way that Gavin and Dazen love and loathe each other. Without fighting to that draw and stopping, I couldn't explore what happens when brothers break the rules and keep on going. Without seeing how hard a good father had to work to shape headstrong young men, I couldn't have written how badly awry things go when a bad father picks a favorite. The Black Prism is a story of emperors and prisoners and magic, set in a Mediterranean 1600-esque world. It's a fantasy story. It's fast and fun and inventive, but I like to think that it's a human story most of all. A story of a fat kid who feels like an outsider. A story of complicated love. A story of trying to keep secrets from those who know us best. A story of trying to prove someone wrong. It is, to the best of my ability, a story of what Faulkner called the human heart in conflict with itself. So I lied. When I cheated in college, it was for love. The kind of love that tweaks a nose, jabs with an elbow, and finally pats a back. That cheating, that love, is the source of the Black Prism. I hope you really enjoy it, but just a little bit more than that, I hope my brother does. Thank you. Okay, and now I'm into the part of the night where I ask you guys for questions, and the first person who goes, I will do my best to humiliate you and make you look foolish in front of. No, I'm just kidding. It's very friendly and very easy. So I would normally leave the mic, but apparently we're recording this, so I'll carry it around. So does anybody have any questions for me tonight? Any questions at all? I know the first one's always hard. Yes, ma'am. The inspiration for that was probably light fascinates me. Light fascinates me because light is where, if you look at the history of science, we always understood science in terms of, or we'd look at the human body in terms of the present metaphor. So people would look at things like hydraulically, or things they'd look at the human like the human is like a steam engine, and those metaphors would keep changing. And with the way we understand that the world is through, now it's like, oh yeah, my hard drive seems a little screwier, or that was just in RAM and then I forgot it. We define our world through metaphors, and we define a lot of the external world through metaphors. And with light, metaphors don't work, because you say it's a particle. No, it's not. It's a wave. No, actually, it's not. It's a particle wave. And we don't have anything in our existence that is like a particle wave. You measure it over here, and then that affects somehow magically across bounds without touching it what happened to the other one that's over here. Schrödinger's cat that's dead and not dead at the same time. There's all this really, really weird stuff about light that is totally mind-boggling. And I took a class in college that was co-taught by a philosopher, a theologian, and a scientist. And they were all talking about light and how that works and how it doesn't work and how it translates to philosophy or theology and how it doesn't. And it's vastly complicated, and it was way over my head. So that's part of what has light fascinates me. In a fantasy novel, you have to take things that fascinate you, and then you have to figure out, like, I can't just talk to you about, straight philosophy or something for 25 pages, because it gets boring. And certainly some authors kind of do that, and it gets boring. So it's a matter of integrating and simplifying things into the world in a way that has depth, but isn't totally overwhelming and needs mathematical equations. So in the Black Prism, what I decided to do is I said, look, you take something simple like a candle. Everybody understands a candle. You light it, it lets out heat and light, and then it's gone. When it the tallow itself disappears, and where'd it go? It went into heat and light. And I thought, let's do a magical system that's the opposite of that. You're taking light and you're making it into something physical. And then I thought, with each color, it'll have different properties. Well, then you can use each of those things differently. So it's like I sort of opened this vast toy box for myself by just saying, look, if you make it, if you put a fireball in your hand, you want to throw it at the other guy, don't make it too big because it's heavy. And if you make it too big, it might squash you. So just by making the rules apply and then saying, okay, each color is going to have its own, this one's going to be more liquid, this one's going to be heavier, this one's going to be slick, this one, and making them different, by actually imposing more rules on myself, I actually give myself more things to play with. And I hope, as you read, more things for you guys to play with and sort of an imaginative play, an imaginative playland, I guess it is. So That's a long answer to a short question, but thank you. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
What sort of criticism hits you hardest? I know there's a lot of good reviews out there. But do you give those as much freedom as you do negative reviews, or vice versa?
I guess the reviews where I feel like they're unjust are the ones that hit me. Like people can say, like one of my first big review that came out when Night Angel came out, and unfortunately this was like in like the biggest sci-fi fantasy blog, which I won't name, but the guy was like, "This seems really like YA writing." And I was like, okay, that's really bizarre, because I would not call my books by any stretch YA. And the characters are really flat. And I was like, every writer has their fastball. The things that they do really well. And the good news, if you're a writer, is you don't have to do them all amazingly well. You can have your strengths as long as you do everything acceptably. You know, like John Grisham, okay? John Grisham's characters are flat. But he has rising tension on every single page. Every page that you read is good, and there's higher stakes, and there's more happening, and there's new things you're learning. He does that really, really well. So big deal that he's got flat characters. So for me, I do characters really, really well. So you get hit with a review like that says characters aren't any good. You go, well, you just missed it. So that doesn't really hurt my feelings, even though it was sort of a bummer from like sales perspective or whatever. And then there's reviews that hit things that like his descriptions didn't seem that great or whatever, or his world building just seemed like I'd seen that before. And with Night Angel, I was able to go, okay, those are totally valid. Those are valid criticisms. And if you are really, really into that, I get that. That's fair. And of course I work on those things, and I try to become better. So that's when people are unfair to you or in other ways, you know, just mean to you, or you feel like they're judging this guy by this standard and then me by some other standard that they pulled out of nowhere, that stinks, you know. Like because I'm not Shakespeare, I totally suck, but this guy, hey, he's really great, you know. And I'm like, I don't want to name any names. So this is going on the internet. Yeah, okay, I'll just leave it there. Yes. Yeah, it's true. This is my wife, so I gave her permission to interrupt me when I'm going on too long or whatever. It's she always has that permission too. So, and she has to use it, unfortunately, fairly often. It's this weird thing about human nature where, like, if people praise me, especially if they praise me really highly, you sort of discount them and you don't count it. But some jackass comes in and says something mean to you, like, dude, this book was so bad, I punched myself in the face. I got that actually. So this guy was like, you know, I love Night Angel, and you were on such a good thing there. What happened to you? This book, I threw it across the room and I punched myself in the face. And I was like, wow. And that kind of bummed me out. You know, I wish I could just be like, yeah, there's jerks in the world and you ignore them. But it takes, you know, sometimes I'm bummed out for the rest of the day, and then the next day I'm like, there's jerks in the world, so you ignore them and you move on. It's like the rejection, I just see it's part of the cost. If people are going to say nice things to you, there's going to be people out there who say mean things to you. And that comes from a lot of different places, you know. It comes from personally people's different places. Like, they feel like your books are really successful, and they aren't that good, so it's unfair. So they, you know, or they're an unpublished novelist, and they're really ticked that they're getting rejected and rejected and rejected, which I totally understand. So then they want to take it out on somebody, which I also understand, but just wish it wouldn't be me. A couple more questions. Yes.
As the
Which one is my favorite books out of the Night Angel trilogy? That's a pretty tough question. I think the one that was the easiest to write, the one that was the most fun to write, was the middle book, Shadow's Edge, and that was because I had already set up the world. You already knew what was going on, who people were, and I was able to just focus on the story and sort of go really, really fast and introduce characters willy-nilly if I wanted to. And I didn't have to worry about tying up all these horrible plot lines because I could do that in the third book. So that book was just pure fun to write, and I probably wrote it the fastest of the three. Looking back, I guess The Way of Shadows has a really special place in my heart, though. Some of the things I did, like you go back and you read things years later, like I don't look at my stuff for years and years, but then I see certain passages and I go, wow, did I write that? That was pretty cool. Of course, there are also those passages I'm like, dude, one more editing pass. Come on, one more. So it's a mixed bag. Okay, let's go with two more questions, and then we'll get to the signing. In the back, yes, sir.
I'm supposed to ask you, if you're in a cage match with Peter B. Brett, who's
going to
win?
Oh, come on. If I'm in a cage match with Peter Brett, who's going to win? Clearly, Joss Whedon is going to win. fair enough. Okay, one more question. Yes?
All right, another light question. Why is there no purple?
Why is there no purple / indigo on the color spectrum? That's actually a really interesting question. Part of it has to do with how each... When you look at light, I wish I'd brought some of my props. I was going to do that after, like I figured nobody's read the book yet when I'm on this tour, so I'm not going to bore you all with all the light stuff. But there's little graphs of like scientifically the color bands, and you look at them, and of course it's a spectrum. I mean it's a gradation, and it goes, and some of the colors in that band are really really narrow, like I think yellow and green are very narrow on the band, while like red is huge. So obviously we don't name colors just on, okay, well 100 nanometers of that is going to be red, and then the next 100 will be you know orange, and the next 100 will be yellow. We don't do that. And it turns out that actually every culture judges colors differently. So some cultures have indigo as part of their spectrum, and some cultures don't. And some cultures like you can look at this, and cultures if they have only two color words, I know they're not really colors, but they have black and white. And if they have three, the third is always red. And so the way that cultures parse their colors is a total, it's not a scientific thing. It's not a human thing. It's a cultural thing, actually, interestingly enough. So the reason I didn't use indigo is they don't parse their colors that way. And also it screwed up my seven color thing. but purple would be a it's a combined color, so it's red plus blue, so it's not a natural part of the color spectrum. So if you're taking combined things, that's a whole different. I'm learning a little bit about optics, and it's very very confusing and kind of cool. But we're getting there slowly. So on the next book tour, I'll talk all about that stuff. It'll be really cool, I promise. I guess we're going to wrap it up there. I will be very happy to sign whatever you guys have brought in. However, I would say I really appreciate the Tattered Cover for being our hosts tonight, and they've been very awesome to work with. And so please buy something while you're here so that they have a good night like I've had a good night spending time with you guys. So thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.